Before we start today's episode, I want to give a quick shout out to Zencastr, which is a podcaster's best friend. Trust me when I tell you this, Zencastr is like a Shopify for podcasters. It's all you need to get up and running as a podcaster. And the best thing about Zencastr is that you get so much stuff for free. If you're planning to check out the platform, then please show your support for the Founder Thesis podcast by using this link, zen.ai/founderthesis. That's zen.ai/founderthesis.
Hi, I'm Vikas Garg, co-founder of Paytail.
Ek minute ruk jao, ready hone do. Chalo, ye kar lete hain. This could be a great intro.
Hi, I'm Akshay.
Hi, this is Saurabh, and you are listening to the Founder Thesis podcast. We meet some of the most celebrated startup founders in the country,
and we want to learn how to build a unicorn.
BNPL, or Buy Now, Pay Later, is one of the fastest growing categories within the fintech space, and there is a good reason why. If a retailer is able to offer you the option to buy a product without having to pay for the entire thing on the spot, then it greatly increases the chances that you will actually buy the product. And there are studies which show that offering BNPL can increase sales by as much as 30%, which is a massive growth in sales. No wonder investors love BNPL startups like Zest Money, Simple and Lazy Pay, which have raised hundreds of millions of dollars so far. However, even in this crowded market, there is one wide open unaddressed space. On the one side, you have the online BNPL startups I just mentioned, which help you when you are making an online payment. And then you have traditional players like Bajaj Finserv, which convert your offline purchases with tier 1 retailers into EMIs. But there's a whole large category of tier 2 and 3 retailers who are not covered by any BNPL fintech. And this is where a company like Paytail comes in. Vikas Garg saw this unaddressed opportunity in offering offline BNPL through a tech-driven approach, which led him to start up Paytail that makes it as easy for an offline retailer to offer BNPL as an online retailer. Listen on to discover the magic of BNPL and the disruption that Paytail is bringing in.
Delhi was a, I would say, completely transformational journey. And from that perspective, I would say a management degree or a management course kind of exposes you in multiple directions. That's when you really start understanding what a business is and what kind of nuances you're. And that's where I would say somewhere deep down in me, the ambition was shown that, you know, outside of a tier 3 city, outside of a packaging unit, there is a lot which can be done. And I could figure that out very, very clearly that, boss, if you have to really elevate yourself and go to the next level, this is what you really want. I was selected for the corporate banking role, which at that point of time, it used to be one of the pivoted role. I was continuing in the corporate banking and asset-based approach for quite some time. That's when I met another company, which at that point of time used to be called as Priority Vendor. I met Kunal, who's still a very, very good and close friend. They were actually looking to solve the same problem
as what you did in Religare, like supply chain financing.
What I did in the last 4 years of my career from then, they were solving the same problem, but with a totally different lens. And that lens was a technology lens. Right? So that's when I kind of got to know that, okay, there is a problem statement and there is a already set up solution. How do you really approach it to solve it? But if you really think hard to solve the same problem, there are multiple ways. And that's what Kunal was doing in Priority Vendor. And then that made me kind of super excited. While we were in my banking career, we were leveraging upon the bank's own or the balance sheet to lend it to the small businesses and the corporates. Kunal, on the other hand, in Priority Vendor, they were actually doing a fantastic job, where they said that, hey, look, we can actually spin off a dynamic discounting platform where we can use excess cash lying on the corporate's own balance sheet to redistribute that cash across the small business's ecosystem. And we can generate a win-win situation for everyone, because for a small business, he's getting immediate access to cash. And for a large enterprise client, they're actually getting some sort of arbitrage. in the entire transaction. So
the enterprise and the small business would have to be related parties, or it can just go to any small business?
So it works like this. Think about a multi-billion dollar company, let's say ITC. Now, ITC has approximately thousands of businesses supplying to them, 15,000 approximately, right? So someone is supplying goods, products, services, logistics, plethora of stuff. Now, there is a credit period which is involved here, that whenever a business supplies, ITC will pay them back, which is part of any standard business. What we used to do for all of these small businesses, as soon as they complete the supply, we will basically throw an offer at them that, hey, here is your offer. If you are ready to offer a discount at about 12% annualized rate, 10% annualized rate, and that is where the entire algorithm of the technology used to discover on the go. There was an entire algorithm written, and the algorithm will tell you what kind of discount would appeal to what kind of audience. Depending on that, they would basically place their bids, their bets, and you would get the money from corporate's own balance sheet and redistribute that money into the supplier ecosystem. So the businesses are already trading.
ITC money would go to ITC vendors only. It's not like, say, ITC money going to Unilever vendors. That would not happen.
But there obviously used to be a crossover, because the guy who's supplying to an ITC is also supplying to Unilever and a lot of other enterprise guys in the same domain. So it's not that you're solving for a very, very small portion of the kitty. You're actually catering to a large working capital requirement from a small business perspective. And that used to be really, really valuable. And that's where I really learned that, you know, what kind of role technology can play into everyday business. And the same problem statements which the traditional or the legacy players have been trying to solve in a different way, there is still a better solution with which you can attack the same problem.
And what was their monetization, like a priority vendor?
So the revenue model was purely success-based, like any other SaaS company. So whatever arbitrage we are able to generate for the corporates, there would be a cut that we will have in between, because that arbitrage has purely come in because there was a investment that we had done in the tech, and there was a discovery, price discovery that we were doing for every transaction.
Okay. And what was the journey for a vendor? Like, a vendor would upload his invoice if he wanted that money upfront. That was the process, or was it like linked to the ERP of ITC? The moment a vendor invoice is submitted, the vendor will get a proposal that, hey, you want this money today, get it at, like, you know, you'll get 98% or 96%, whatever. So get it at this rate.
The latter. We were integrated with every single corporate that we were onboarding at the enterprise client. And then we were just redistributing the money. And it was a fairly interesting model. And eventually, 1.5 years down the line, we could also bring in some of the world's most largest banks to participate in the marketplace. So, and all of these banks were essentially the multinational corporations, all the way from Japan to London to everywhere, right? The 4-5 big, very, very big wins that we had done on the banking. So it's a very highly successful model. And CTF, so it's a low-risk proposition and a high-volume proposition for everyone. And everyone wins. The bank wins, the enterprise clients win, and the small businesses, they definitely win. Because this is one of the most important problem statement what every small business is facing. And what really needs to be solved globally and at a very, very large scale.
So how come I haven't heard of Priority Vendor? Like, it's so under the radar.
I'll tell you. So Priority Vendor got acquired by a US-based company called C2FO, which was also doing the same business, albeit at a very, very large scale, because Priority Vendor was more like a domestic player. And C2FO was present across, I think, 100 countries already. So that's when the takeover happened, and there were some clear synergies. Because when there are two very, very large players existing in the same economy, right? There's no point getting into a price war when you can, you know, just join hands and bring out a lot more synergies on the table. If we really kind of come together, can we really solve the agenda at a much, much larger scale than what individually either of us can really solve? But I would say that was the thought process in the right direction for both the founder, Sandy of C2FO, and Kunal of Priority Vendor. And that was my, in fact, one more learning in the entire process. that this has to be the really progressive thought process of every single founder out there.
Okay. And did you stay on once the acquisition happened, or like what did you do then?
I stayed on for quite some time, I'd say. And that's when I think my thought process on the entire market was also developing. Because now it's really deep. I had done enterprise sales for quite some time. I had been catering to the small businesses for the longest time. Every time we used to meet a corporate, our enterprise client, they used to say that, boss, you know, this problem has already been solved up to the large extent now.
Okay. This supply chain financing. Okay.
This supply chain finance, right? There are big players like you.
I think Vayana Network is also doing this. CredEx is also doing this.
Lot of players. But when I used to meet on my enterprise clients, there used to be one unanimous ask, which everyone would come back and would really, you know, ask thought-provoking questions. People would say that this problem has already been solved up to a large extent, but what really needs to be solved and what really matters is the problem right at the bottom of the supply chain. It's not at tier one. Tier one, to the guy who supplied to a billion-dollar corporate itself is a fairly decently placed guy. But when you talk about this last mile on the last bottom of the pyramid, which is the retailer sitting in the market, that is where the problem lies. Because it doesn't really matter how much working capital you have.
But retailers get a credit period, no? I mean, they don't have to pay upfront for whatever they are buying, right?
Well, there are multiple models, Akshay. And it entirely depends upon the industry that you're talking about. So, for example, in FMCG industry, there is no credit as such. The retailer literally pays upfront to get the stock lifted, right? And talk about or probably that would also be true for a large tire manufacturer. But that may not be true in a power solution industry. Or, for example, in an electronic industry, there are different playbooks, depending on how each of these industries and how each of the players are positioned.
Depending on the margin also, I guess. Like if it's high margin product, then they would be more willing to give credit. And
absolutely. But essentially, the important point to note here is that each of these retailers that we speak about, these are all multi-brand guys. Everyone is multi-brand.
They'll buy Coke and Pepsi both, like not just one.
Everything. They'll just keep the entire stock loaded. And just to make sure that the customer doesn't kind of goes away and they're able to have maximum conversions. And we are not only talking about from an FMCG standpoint here, this applies across the industries. So even if you talk about the tires or, you know, any industry that you pick, this fundamental, which is uniform across the country. And from an enterprise standpoint, now, of course, everyone would want to increase the wallet share at the retailer's counter. And people, I mean, fight really hard, neck to neck, to achieve that objective, right? If you really go there and listen to that guy, almost every seller is going to tell you one thing, which is like, they call it like dhande ki baat. Ki boss, I want to increase my sales and I want to increase my profitability, right? Unanimous problem statement to solve across all the sellers. And if you really ask them that, hey, what's wrong with your sales, man? You're making a, it's kicking, right? You're sitting in the prominent location and everything is going good. That's when they would tell you an intuitive metric. If you, of course, ask them the data point, they may not be able to share that CRM data with you. But because they've been running the business for over a decade now, and probably the second generation has also entered, they would really give you an intuitive figure. That, boss, if 100 people come to my store, I am able to convert only 30, 35, maximum 40 people out of that. And the remaining 60 people will not buy.
Yeah, because I don't have what they need. Like, I don't have that brand or that SKU. Like,
so I classify this largely as two problems, sub problems, right? The reasons could be distribution, because like you said, they don't have what the customer really wants. There could be a specific requirement, right? Or the capital. The product that the customer, the merchant is selling, the guy doesn't even have enough money or the budget is not there to really afford that kind of product, to afford the product from a consumer perspective, right? And that is That is where, because of these two simple reasons, a majority of the fallouts happen. From my standpoint, when I was looking at this space, and almost every single enterprise client in CPG group, consumer product group, comes back and tell you that, boss, something needs to be done at the bottom of the pyramid. I am a very, very motivated guy after that, right? So then I started researching. And I'd say that just after first wave, when Unlock One started and just started happening, by the time I finished my research, I read about all about the space. And I was super excited about it. And COVID kind of gave me that time. Because otherwise, you're always half of my life,
out on the field, meeting clients.
Yeah. So COVID gave me that time. I finished my research. And I was super, super excited and geeked about the entire space. I spoke with a couple of my friends. One of my ex-colleague, Amit Chaturvedi, who's also my co-founder. We spent hours discussing.
Ex-colleague from where? Like
C2FO, priority vendor. Yeah, we worked for almost 3.5 years there together, solving for the same thing. And we actually spent hours talking about this entire space and the idea and how a huge blue ocean opportunity is still lying out there. And there are different lenses with which we will be able to solve it.
But what did you decide as the product that you would offer? Like, what was the thesis? You know, like you said, the philosophy behind the business, what was that like?
So, okay, the philosophy still remains the same, right? So what we thought of, that if this is really the problem statement to solve, we actually went to the market and we had a few ideas, which we kind of iterated with a lot of the retailers. And since there were not many people outside in the market and the footfall was fairly low at that point in time, we actually had that opportunity to actually sit over a cup of tea. They would give us time and we'd spend about 15, 20 minutes, half an hour talking to each of these folks.
What were the options you were exploring, like in terms of the options to how to solve?
So the thesis that, okay, there are few problem statements which potentially can be solved. Number one problem is that, can you solve for credit of the merchant, right? That is one. Number two,
So that he can store more SKUs because he doesn't have to pay upfront.
That he doesn't have to pay upfront. So can you basically extend some a bit more credit to the merchant? And the second piece is for the merchant.
BNPL for the merchant, yeah.
BNPL for the merchant, right? That was the first thought. And the second iteration that we wanted to kind of chat on, can we spin off a hyper-local play, right? Where it's a super hyper-local kind of stuff. People in the same vicinity are able to see the stocks and of what the merchant is keeping, and they're able to buy so that we are able to bring more customers to them. That was the second thought process. But we were a little cautious on the second one, because there were a lot of hyper-local journeys which had already been traveled and which kind of landed in a tizzy because of one reason or the other.
Yeah. I mean, hyper-local is like extremely high burn strategy.
That is right. So we actually went with these couple of theses to the market, where we really wanted to understand from them that, hey, what can we really do for you, right? And that's when we learned about this, some of the statistics which I just mentioned, that they are only able to convert about 40% of the customers and the remaining are just returning. When we were chatting with them, what came out of the entire conversation? That probably credit may not be the best of the idea to solve for. Because credit, by its very nature, it remains a push product. Right? Because when you're extending the credit to the merchant, you suddenly have five people, different quadrants, selling probably almost similar, non-differentiated credit product to the guy. So that's when you end up getting into the price war again, and you screw up. And it still kind of remains a push product. When we wanted to do something, we really wanted to have something on the table which is a pull product. Right? And there was a lot of noise from the kind of merchants that we met, that if someone can help me in converting even the footfall which is coming to my store here, forget about bringing more customers. The customers who are coming to my store already, if someone can help me in converting 10 more customers. It's a 33% jump in my business, right? Someone can convert me, help me converting 15 more customers. It's a 50% jump to my business. So how do you really convert to them? How do you really convert the customers? Again, the same two problem statement why the fallouts happen. Distribution, capital. But distribution is something that you cannot really solve for. Because like, for example, there's a chip problem going on. The entire industry is struggling because of that. And there are some raw material shortages. And that's going to continue because of each of the industry nuances. So that's probably not in the hands of any single player to come in and solve for from a distribution standpoint. What remains is the capital. And that's when we started going deep. And in the initial apprehension was that, boss, within capital, there are 800 pound gorillas sitting in the market. What are you going to do so differently?
Who's offering credit to retailers? I don't think there's... are there players who are targeting retailers? Like,
there are many players. I mean, each and every bank, each and every NBFC, because these retailers have their current account somewhere, right? And we are not offering credit to the retailers, by the way, as yet. The product is different, which I'll just talk about. But to answer your question, yes. I mean, there's a decent amount of penetration, which is already there. So again, there are two categories, right? There are people who everyone wants to fund. Every bank wants to fund them. Every NBFC wants to fund them. He doesn't need you. And category where no one wants to fund. When you're anyhow dependent upon some third party capital, and you're talking about a guy who no one wants to fund, what are you talking about? Then how are you going to fund it? Right? So it's kind of the mathematics works like that. But that said, there is still a bit of opportunity in the space, which I'm sure a lot of the peer fintech founders or the new age companies they are trying to solve for. But our take on the market actually became a little different when we started speaking with these guys. And when they said that, hey, if you can really solve for the capital problem of my consumer, if you can basically provide something which is instant access to capital the moment they step into my store to buy something, that's going to be magical, right? Our initial impression was that, you know, there are 800-pound gorilla sitting in the market. They're very, very large players who are already trying to solve for the checkout finance in the offline environment. What are you going to do so differently? What other people have not been able to solve for? That's when we found three anomalies, right? Number one, in the current environment of offline checkout finance, the entire market is skewed towards just two industries, which are the, in our language, what we call as legacy industries, mobile and electronics, consumer durables. And almost everyone, including both of us, we are aware about how that market has been functioning for last one decade. And the players in that segment, they have done a magnificent job. And they continue to be an inspiration till date. With whatever they have done in the space so far, right? Other than these two categories, anything and everything just hugely remains underpenetrated. I mean, from a if I'm a consumer, if I'm buying a 30,000 rupees phone, or if I'm buying a replacement pack of tires for my car, which is still going to cost me 25 grand, 30 grand, for me, it's still a cash outlay. So I have no reason why do I really differentiate. And that was kind of one of the theses that, you know what, there are just umpteen number of industries, umpteen number of segments which are hugely underpenetrated. And this was one anomaly which we saw in the market. The second anomaly which we saw, other than the large retail counters, and those large retail counters could be an organized retail, you know, the multi-brand organized retails, or some of the large counters in specific markets in a tier one, tier two city. The long tail, the small merchants, and that small merchant could be selling a bicycle. And these days, they have pretty fancy bicycles, by the way. Huh? Yeah. And could be selling tires, it could be selling power solution, it could be selling furniture, it could be a dental clinic, whatever it is, right? Almost all of these guys, they really struggle to have something which is just as instant what as they really want. So this was the second anomaly, right? The third anomaly that we saw, that even if in the situations where the checkout finance options are available, the entire experience, what an e-com platform can really deliver to the consumer vis-a-vis what you can really get in an offline environment, is diagonally opposite, boss. Diagonally opposite, right? So someone's got to solve this. Our playbook was set. That was a moment our playbook was set. Okay, boss, this is what we got to do. No one is looking at this piece. No one is probably solving for. And even if people try to solve for, we are talking about a overall market opportunity of a little over $300 billion.
If you like to hear stories of founders, then we have tons of great stories from entrepreneurs who have built billion-dollar businesses. Just search for the Founder Thesis podcast on any audio streaming app like Spotify, Gaana, Apple Podcasts, and subscribe to the show.
Yeah, I want to just do a quick summary here. So what you wanted to build was an experience as smooth as a BNPL on, say, Amazon, where you're buying and you have an option to pay later, seamless, within 1 or 2 minutes, everything is done. So the customer experience should be as good as that and available across categories and across sizes of retailers. So while, say, traditionally, you could get this at, say, like a Vijay or like some of these big names, but you can't get this in smaller names. So you wanted to make this available in the long tail and across categories, be it tires, be it like a dental, like a root canal procedure or whatever, right?
And being geo-neutral. Geo-neutral. That's also the one of the most important part.
Tier 1, tier 2, tier 3, like across, right? Got it.
Just everywhere. The people staying everywhere, all of these are households. There's a certain set of income which is already there. And technology is the solution which can really help you in reaching to all of these masses, be it the merchants or be it the consumers. While the thesis is still kind of was set in stone that, hey, how do we really make sure that the guy sitting on the ground who's been retailing for almost a decade and a half really feels the power of the solution? And we are able to deliver the value which we started the entire business with. That continues to be the thesis.
I would imagine the biggest challenge would be that 2-minute approval, what you get online, you know, that would be the biggest thing to solve, right? Like if you can give those customers that instant approval when they are paying for something.
Then when you really look at a checkout finance kind of product and the way kind of we have set up our playbook, from a consumer perspective, we are actually offering everything. Whatever that retailer is selling, everything on a 0% EMI. So he could be selling a geyser or a mixer grinder. I'm just talking about even the small ticket items. Because when you go as a consumer, you just tend to club these items and your overall bill still comes to be about 12,000, 30,000, 15,000. Right? So if you really club these items and whatever be the brand that they're selling, even if it's a non-brand, the thesis still stays true that how can we offer a 0% EMI for the consumer in which they don't really have any incremental interest cash outlay from their own pocket made available to the consumer right at the point of sale with a journey which is as simple as you would experience on a typical e-com platform.
No, but tell me about how you will solve this. How will you give interest-free EMI? What is the journey to solve this? Like,
so there are two elements to it. I'll just give you a use case. So we've got, we are actually tied up with one of the largest tire manufacturers, a very big name in the country, right? And these guys are very, very active. In fact, 65% of their turnover, which is about $2 billion, actually comes in from replacement market tires, right? which is not when you're buying a fresh car. It's like when you're going for a replacement of the tires. And within that cohort, if you look at 65% of a cohort, 20% of that top line actually comes from the PCV, passenger car vehicle segment. And the remaining come from, large commercial vehicle, small commercial vehicle, blah, blah, blah. The way we solve it, we first of all tie up with the corporate. And the corporate sees a clear value prop. Because for them also, they've experienced this. That, as soon as we are approaching winters and the tires of your car kind of run off, everyone kind of delays a buying decision. That, hey, let me just approach summer and that's when I'm going to change. And that's probably goes against the entire safety ethos that each of these corporates is basically talking about in the market. So when they hear about this kind of solution, which can instantly enable the consumer walking into the merchant store to start taking an accelerated buying decision and also opens a door for the merchant to cross-sell and upsell. It's a no-brainer. Like any bigger small business would really want to do this. And what's more important here, that these players are also super happy to participate in the program by putting in their skin in the game in terms of subvention. That, okay, if someone is buying my brand tires, I'm more than happy to offer a 6-month no-cost EMI or a 9-month no-cost EMI, depending upon the margin structure of each industry. They would actually subvent that entire interest cost from their own pocket so that the consumer doesn't have to bear anything, right? The moment we complete the tie-up, we go to every single retailer that they have in their ecosystem. And there's a very beautiful, intuitive mobile application, which is there for the merchants, where unlike the experience that they have with legacy players, where the approval takes as long as 2 weeks, and it's not really a geo-neutral strategy for the legacy folks, right? Here, the merchant just downloads the application, completes his own approval process. It's a verified approval journey, which we have built in the merchant application. And as soon as they complete it, they're activated instantly because there is a scorecard which runs at the background. And whosoever is passing through the scorecard, they get activated instantly. That, okay, you are my partner merchant, recommended by a tire manufacturer, which is also a brand associated with me. And you are activated instantly to start offering an EMI to all of your customers walking into the doorstep. So that's the registration part of the merchant. And that's how we activate each and every merchant. And within the mobile application, we'll show them all the offers because the corporates also want to kind of, show some incentives.
Promote like trade marketing, their trade marketing stuff.
Trade marketing, the entire gamification strategy that, hey, how do I really enable the guy to sell more? Because that's the entire objective here, right? Now, what's interesting to note here, tomorrow, in fact, we are actually speaking on a good day. Tomorrow, we are also launching all-in-one powerful QR code. So it's going to be one QR code, which we will ship to every single retailer signing up with us, right? It's going to work on UPI. It's going to work on all the debit card EMIs. And we have a few partners in that space. It's going to work on all the credit card EMIs. And it's also going to work through Paytm's own mobile application for an instant credit of up to 2 lakh rupees. So it's all in one. You've merged everything into one single QR code. So imagine you are a consumer. You just walk into the doorstep. You're seeing all the merchandise, which is Paytm co-branded merchandise on the merchant counter that, hey, you can just pick up anything. And anything and everything is on a 0% EMI. Even if intuitively, it's kind of start training your brain. Right? So even if you don't have the budget, even if you are, while you were entering, you were a little apprehensive that, hey, how much the tire is going to really cost me? Will I be able to really buy it today or not? Right? All of those apprehensions suddenly vanishes. And what does the trick on top of that when the retailer tells you and promotes that, hey, you know what? Here's an offer. I'm just going to offer you a 0% EMI. Why don't you just make the decision right now? That seals the deal.
He has one more tool in his arsenal. If a customer says mehenga hai, he can say EMI mein convert kar lo.
EMI mein convert kar lo, sasta ho jayega aapke liye. 0% hai, you don't really have to pay any interest cost as well. The guy just scans the UPI QR code, download first my application, registers himself by putting in his name, mobile number. That's if you don't offer anything else. scans the UPI QR code. We come to know that what is he buying, from which merchant he is buying. And there's a data science engine which runs in the background, which we have built, which depending upon the historical trend at the merchant counter, clubbed with the credit quality of the consumer.
How do you get credit quality of consumer? Because you're not doing any KYC, like you're not taking his PAN, Aadhaar and all. No, you're just...
So we are not taking physical documents. And that's been another trick, right? We are not really dependent on the guy to submit his physical documentation to us or even through the application or a couple of other KYC journeys. Like, for example, even if the guy has a DL, driving license, that is also supported. So either of these KYC documents, just the number would work. And we are already integrated with some of the golden sources from the backend. The moment the guy enters the information, we fetch out of this information directly from the government source, government servers. And we are able to run a verification engine that he's the same guy who is signing up. It is the same KYC, right? And then we also have access to, because we are partnered with credit, institutions, which are largely NBFCs also. We get access to the entire, we get access to the entire scorecard where they are able to pass along an instant decisioning.
But do you get access to scorecards through driving license? I thought you need like a PAN or a Aadhaar for accessing credit history.
So PAN you need, and there are a few more parameters like gender you need, date of birth you need, all of that stuff, right? So that is a,
like PAN is a must have, right? Like if someone doesn't have a PAN, then he wouldn't qualify for credit, right?
Yes, that's right. That's the limitation today. PAN card is still a mandatory requirement as part of the platform as yet. So we take the PAN card, we take some of the basic, very, very basic information, none of which is actual document. The guy just completes a, I think, less than 1.5 minute journey in giving us this input. We combine it.
Probably the camera can just point at the PAN card and the app would scan the number and all that, right? Yeah.
Not needed. Not needed. You just need to enter the PAN number. That's it. That's all we need, right? And we need a selfie of the guy. We need the PAN number and we need either of the KYC number, not the document. We just pull all of this information together, run a verification engine, put it through a scorecard, run it through the credit partners that we have that, hey, I mean, is this guy fitting into the credit criteria? And then also marry it along with the data science engine that we have built on the alternate data, what the merchant has been supplying, right? Because that's, again, the thesis is that the category of the merchant, the size of the merchant, location of the merchant, the brand of the merchant would actually have a direct material impact on the quality of the credit that he's originating. So that's a very, very valuable parameter that you possibly skip in the journey and which kind of acts as a direct alternative lending methodology. And we marry it along with the score that we are generating on the consumer. And that's what kind of makes sure that our approval rates would typically be a little higher in comparison to a less just to consumer underwriting approach. If there's a merchant, hypothetically, I mean, and we have few cases in that sense, right? If there's a merchant which is sitting in a tier 3 city, a smaller town, which has already been giving us some really good, high quality consumers. And if a consumer is not repaying on time, because that consumer is also staying in the vicinity. He's also following up that cost, you know what, there's a relationship that I have already. So it's a very integrated play.
So the merchant scorecard gets hit if his consumers don't pay. So he is incentivized to kind of push and make sure that they pay.
It is like for all the merchant partners who are truly attached with us, we also reciprocate from all the possible angles. So for a guy who's been taking care of my portfolio and has been using the application with the best of the intentions in mind, which we kind of rate him on the go. And we also tell him that this is a scorecard that I am not going to rate you. This is something which is under your control. You are going to control your own scorecard. If you really, bump the score up, do these three things. It's going to go up. We tell him transparently, utmost, that this is what you need to do and the score is going to go up, right? And if the guy does really well, we also make sure that none of his customers really leaves without, I mean, for the reason of not having access to capital. We go at lengths to make sure that.
Yeah. So the approval is like it's like a weighted average of merchant score plus customer score.
And a few more. I mean, and it's a large kind of data science engine that we have on our side. And there are a lot of parameters which get considered. We also...
Like location and stuff like that.
Stuff like that.
Location, product category, like some product categories would have higher NPA, some would have lower NPA.
Uh-huh. Oh, yes. Like I said, actually, you pick up really well. Really deep in the space, huh?
It's the advantage of being a podcaster and talking to so many founders. You get to learn a lot. So how do you know what product he's buying? Because like you said, these retailers sell multiple brands. Now, suppose one tire brand you have a tie-up with, say Apollo you have a tie-up with, or say Bridgestone you have a tie-up with. How do you know that this customer is actually buying Bridgestone and not some other brand where the merchant is just taking advantage of the Bridgestone collaboration and passing on that interest cost to Bridgestone? Like how does that happen? Like,
so there are various mechanisms. Like, I'll give you an example, a use case of a large electrical company. It's a $500 million in top line. They were our, second or third client. We do a very, very light touch integration. Which is just a day's job, directly with the ERP of the corporate when we sign up.
Where you get the dealers, whoever are the authorized dealers, you get the data.
We get the data as well. But on top of it, we also get the SKU data. And almost all the large enterprises today, they have fairly foolproof mechanisms, right? Where they are able to identify that which product was made in which factory, and each one has a batch number, each one has a unique identifier code. Each of the product, each of the SKU, right? So when that product is getting shipped, they basically track it from a logistical standpoint, that what is the shelf life and all of that stuff. And all of this entire data is residing in the corporate Sony ERP. What we typically do is, and in this use case, what we are doing, when the consumer is buying it, they basically scan a unique QR code, which is there on the product of the enterprise product. So if you're buying, let's say, a mixer grinder, which is going to cost you about 5,000 rupees, there is going to be a QR code on top of the box, which is going to be unique to only that box.
But that is something which they start doing once they collaborate with you, or they are anyway doing it and you're just getting access to that?
We're getting access to that.
That QR code on the box. Okay.
They're always doing it as part of the normal business, because there are multiple use cases that QR code is solving. It kind of allows them to track the product that which retailer is sent to.
It's helping them in supply chain efficiency. So that's why they're anyway putting a QR code. Okay, so you're just piggybacking on that data.
Piggybacking on the data, and we are verifying it on the go. That is it, first of all, a genuine product? Because, I mean, it should not happen that, you know, while the corporate is paying for the subvention, they're getting charged for some fake product being sold in the market. First of all, it has to be a genuine product. And then once that QR code gets scanned, it can never be funded again. So we mark an entry back into the ERP, and we basically tell the ERP that, okay, this is what we have funded, and this is taken. And that product, that QR code is already kind of taken on finance. And then there are a few alternative checks also that we have built as part of our merchant application, where the merchant also has to submit any information if there is a red flag which is being observed by our system. That this could be a spurious transaction, and the system kind of generates a red flag. And then the merchant has to submit an incremental information, let's say in form of an invoice. So the system will send out a message on the notification on the app, and the merchant will open up the scanner in the app. They will upload the invoice. And then we have an OCR technology, which we are piggybacking on, which is still, we are kind of refining it day by day. Because like I said, it's a huge demographic country that we're dealing with. People are writing those invoices in multiple languages. If it is in English, our system is able to recognize and approve the invoice on the go, or even further raise a red flag. And that's how we are doing that RCA.
What is RCA? Sorry?
The root cause analysis of how, you know, the flag was generated, and was this flag a genuine flag? And is this really a spurious transaction? All of those checks are already built into the system. And this is the use case that we have solved with the electrical company that I spoke about.
What is the customer journey? So a customer comes to a store. He wants to buy, let's say, a microwave oven. And he then tells the guy, okay, I want to buy it. He says, EMI, pe le lo. Then what? Like, he scans a QR code on the cash counter, which will be like a Paytail QR code. And then he does that KYC. Then does he, after that, scan the QR code on the box? Or does the merchant scan it? Or like, how do you come to know what is the transaction that's happening? Is it merchant-driven, customer-driven? Like,
I'll tell you. So as we are talking today, because our QR code is getting launched tomorrow in the market. As on date, the entire journey is merchant-induced. The merchant basically initiates a transaction by selecting the product, a verified product, and he adds that item into the cart of the consumer. Like how a cart would be visible on an e-com site. When the consumer downloads the application, there is a cart which is already present created by some merchant. They are just checking out from that cart.
So the merchant will ask the consumer that, give me your phone number. Then he'll create a profile of that customer with the phone number. And then the customer will download the app with his phone number. So you know, okay, ye khareed raha hai. So his cart already has that product. Then the customer does the rest of the KYC steps. And once approved, then the merchant gets a notification that the money is in your bank.
Absolutely. But from tomorrow, and how it's going to change? The merchant, after registration, they don't really need to pick up the phone. There's a QR code which is there, which is going to be there on the counter. And let's say I walk in as a consumer. We call this journey as a scan and pay. It's a scan and pay journey. You just click on that scan and pay button in the app, scan that QR code in the merchant counter, tell us the product detail. Then now there are two ways. Either you can scan the QR code, which we spoke about. Then we will verify that this is a product and that they are going to get all the offers on that product. There could be a cashback offer. There could be an offer all the way up to a 12-month EMI, right? Or if they don't want to scan the product, there is also an alternative journey where they can select the product from the catalog. That, hey, I am buying an Apple phone, for example, hypothetically, right? And assuming that even if I don't have a tie with Apple, then also we are actually going to offer a 0% EMI as a subvention program up to 3 months. So up to 3 months as a platform, we are offering 0% on everything. Anything and everything that merchant is selling, everything is on 0% EMI if the consumer is selecting up to a 3 month option. And this works really pretty well in a small ticket size item of up to 10,000, 15 grand, something like that, right? Really, really helps the merchant to elevate the sales. So either we are selecting the QR code from the consumer application, scanning it, and we are just telling them, okay, there's a verified product and there's an EMI all the way up to 12 months. If they're not doing that, then we can just tell them that, okay, the EMI low cost is available up to 3 months. If you really want to go up to 12 months, then there's an interest element, then you'll actually have to bear incrementally from your pocket. Okay? And from there, they just kind of completes the journey. So from a merchant perspective, three huge advantages. 0% EMI, everything. Huge. The second thing is, the moment the transaction gets completed, the very same moment, his bank account gets hit with the money. We don't kind of make him wait. There is an element of trust. And even if there's a red flag which is being raised by the system, that is something we'll deal about it later. But as soon as the transaction is completed, the merchant kind of gets the money instantly. And the third, of course, the main advantage here is that mine is an all-in-one platform from a consumer perspective. While I'm offering an instant credit of up to 2 lakhs, there is also a credit card EMI. There is also a debit card EMI. There is also a pre-approved journeys that we are now kind of tying up with various financial institutions and helping them expand into the BNPL space. So from a consumer perspective, it's all-in-one. They just have one application which gives you every single possible source through which you can buy an item on an EMI.
Right. Okay. What do you mean by subvention program? You use that term that you're running a subvention program.
So subvention program is the same program. where the corporate says that please don't charge the consumer, I am going to pay the interest to you. So that's kind of subventing the entire, yes, entire interest component.
So, but you are giving 3 months interest-free EMI even if a corporate is not subventing, right? Like
that's our promotion. That is something that we...
So that's like your customer acquisition cost in a way, like...
Yes, yes. That's right.
Okay. That currently is coming from your pocket.
Absolutely. That's right.
But it gives you data about that customer. So in future, if the customer wants a loan again, then you can show NBFC partner that last time he took a loan from us and he paid back and he's a good customer. So it helps your underwriting engine perform better. Like,
yeah, well, actually, it helps from a consumer perspective. There are a lot of use cases which can eventually be solved. Not too worried about that. Right now, the main focus is to what length can I really go in making sure that the objective for which we have started the business is met. And when you really see the merchant partner struggling, because not every brand that he's selling is actually running a 0% kind of subvention program. Not every. And within the...
Yeah. It'll be very small universe, like maybe 10-20%.
Oh, yes. And within the spec of brands, there will not be an EMI available at a product level. Like I just started the business back then, when I bought this AirPod, it actually costed me a decent amount of money. And I just ended up asking the guy that, hey, do you have an EMI? I said, no, there's an EMI which is available on Apple phone. And I'm standing in a authorized Apple store. And the guy that doesn't have EMI on AirPod. Similarly, for every merchant, there are a plethora of products where they do not have access to EMI, and hence they kind of end up losing the customer. The thesis, core thesis, still remains the same. How do I help the merchant in getting that incremental 10 customers?
Okay. There are like a bunch of things I want to ask you. One is that... do you see yourself as a B2B company or a B2C company? Because, on the one hand, the biggest beneficiary is the merchant. But on the other hand, the more B2C you become, the more powerful or the more valuable the business becomes. Because then, customers can not just use it with existing merchant partners, but they can even help you onboard new merchants. And, then it becomes like a different trajectory of business altogether. So what do you see yourself as?
I think the answer is pretty much clear. Given the use case that we're trying to solve for, it's an interconnected play. If I only solve for the merchant and don't really solve for the consumer, then the amount of impact that I would be able to create on the objective with which I have started the business is going to be limited. On the other hand, if I make it a only consumer play, then the entire value prop kind of becomes a little twisted, because that's not really, as a platform, as a business, as a thesis, that's not really why we started this business for. So I think it's pretty much clear now that this is looking like a more like an interconnected play, where you're
like that's like a diplomatic answer. No, you're saying both. I'm saying if you had to say this is a bigger focus, what would that be?
Okay, let me put it this way. If I have to give you a clear answer, I would still say that for me, because my go-to market is originating from the merchant counter, that's where the entire journey kind of starts from. And that's again gonna be a very, very large element of the entire play, even in the coming times. So I think the clear answer from that perspective is going to be the merchant. If you ask me one single focus area, from a problem statement standpoint, it is a merchant that we have to solve for. From an experience standpoint, it is a consumer what we have to solve for. And if you're really able to marry the two, then you're actually just accelerating the entire value prop from your primary customer, which is merchant.
Got it. I mean, that's broadly what I wanted to understand, because obviously to help the merchant, you need to make it seamless for the consumer. You know, you can't help the merchant if you don't make it seamless for the consumer. But I just wanted to understand, like, which is your true north in a way, you can say, you know, so okay, got that. I also want to understand, like, how will you do acquisition of merchants at scale? I mean, eventually, you know, that will be like a problem to solve, that how do you acquire at scale without doing a lot of burn? Because I mean, like, companies like Paytm, BharatPay, there is a lot of burn that they have done to acquire merchants. What is your approach here? Are you going to follow a similar path and, you know, like, with large fundraisers to acquire merchants, or, you know, what do you see as the path there?
Okay, to answer that, let me, you know, throw some light on the market that I have in front of me. So we are actually dealing with millions of small retailers, and I'm offering them a solution which possibly no one is offering them, and so far only the bigger peers of these guys actually had access to. They were never approved. I mean, even if there's a presence at a tier 3 level, that presence is only to a handful guys, that hey, these are the top 10 guys of the city, let me just, you know, pick them up. And those top 10 guys would be in specific categories. Let me just pick them and, you know, solve for them, which is fine. Everyone has got their own playbook. That is where you really, you know, you really want to struggle with the market by burning a lot of cash. So, and these are two completely different playbooks. And there is nothing called wrong or right. It's all relative. It's all really what you really want to pick and what you really want to solve for. In our market, fortunately, so far, that's not the scenario. Hence the reason when we tie up with any of the enterprise client, and when they have a very, very strong buying in on the product, each of these guys we are talking about, they have thousands of people running on the ground, where their objective in life is that how do I push the product of the corporate? The sales guys, KRA, how do I really make sure that my wallet share at this merchant counter is gonna go up, right? So my product is helping the sales guy in meeting that KRA. That's one. Other than that, we also have set up a fair amount of team on our side. There's a tele setup that we have. In fact, interestingly, we did a sample IVR burst across 5,000 merchant ecosystem. And just on IVR, we actually had a 15% success rate right on the first call. 15% of the guys, they just downloaded the application and they signed up. That's what tells you the power of a differentiated product and the power of when you have a very, very clear value prop for your ecosystem partners, right? So this is how the entire journey is looking at. Our problem has been the other way around. So it's not a question of that how many merchants I can really acquire, right? I mean, I can literally start acquiring like 20,000 customers per month. That's not the problem statement to solve. The problem is, how many merchants can I really service? Given the size and the scale at which we are, if we are able to deliver a real value prop, even to a small cohort of the merchants, and that small cohort could look as small as 4,000 or 5,000, our numbers are almost treble than that. But even if we are able to deliver a real value prop to a 5,000 merchant audience, that's a, I'd say from where I'm standing, from where I'm looking, that's probably the most valuable business to build. Because once you solve that equation at 5,000, the rest is just replicable. You just reapply the same logic, the same equation over 50,000, 5 lakh, and that's how it just keeps going.
Yeah, I want to better understand this challenge in front of you. So like you said, you just need to flick a switch and start onboarding 20,000 merchants a month if you decide to do so. But there is a challenge you want to solve first before going and chasing the scale game. What is the challenge that you want to solve? Is it about making your data engine stronger? Is it about tie-ups with people who will finance it, like the NBFC bank tie-ups? What is that challenge? Or is it like product development and evolution? What is it like?
So I'd say it's a combination of the following things. Number one, of course, the product. We are about 8 months into our journey, and we are present across, we have 14 corporate tie-ups already, and these are all large players of their own segments. each of these industries have different nuances. And whenever we launch one corporate into the market, we always do a small POC. Each one of these guys, they have like 70,000, 100,000 retailer base. And we pick up like 5,000. Like, hey, let's just come together and do a POC. When we hit the market, each of these industries, it actually gives us a lot of product maturity. There are nuances of the market that you really need to capture, right? And come out.
Give me an example, like some new category you entered and how that helped the product become more mature.
So, okay, this is an interesting one. We just signed up with this tire player that I was talking about, right? Now, unlike the electrical example, which I gave you, where it is very, very easy and simple to identify a unique product, tire doesn't come with a QR code, right? If you make the product from a left angle, there's going to be another industry which is just going to come up and surprise you. So how do you really solve that?
But do they have like a serial number like tires? I guess they would have.
No, okay, don't have. They don't have, right? Unfortunately, they don't have that.
Okay, then how did you solve that?
So there we did a small integration because the corporate also had a mobile device. And every time the merchant is initiating a transaction, they actually have to enter the detail of that transaction in their mobile device. Now, instead of doing all of that in their application, they can actually initiate the, because the tire has to go on warranty. Everyone wants warranty on their tire whenever they're spending 25,000 rupees, right? So now you are really controlling that, hey, there's a genuine tire to a genuine consumer being sold by adding another layer of verification into it. When you also solve for a small the warranty part. This again very small example. Now another example would be that there would be a lot of small merchants across the country which would actually not have best of the intentions of using the platform that they get their hands on to it, because there's a huge value prop, right, that we are delivering to them.
Yeah, it's very tempting that show that I'm selling X product and use it to finance Y product. I mean, that's super tempting. Now, you're still increasing your sales, but doing it fraudulently.
It's very tempting. And I'd say that we have also had experiences in the past where people have really studied our entire platform deeply and then come up with the different sort of, you know, funny hacks around it. That, hey, okay, this is how we can do it and all of that stuff. This is what I call as product maturity. Now, when you are having a low profile, you can actually catch some of these things fairly quickly and plug these things in your product. You can't probably do the same thing if we were 10x, 20x of our size what we are today.
Yeah, it's better to make the mistakes when you're small so that the cost of those mistakes is less. If you made those mistakes when you became big, then it would be a costly mistake to make.
And this is one of my favorite line these days, right? If you find a payment company which is growing like a lending company, there's a problem. If you find a lending company which is growing like a payment company, there's a problem.
Because then NPS will shoot up because they are like not being stringent about credit quality. That's why they're...
It's a different DNA. It's a diagonally opposite DNA. On the payment side, they're just taking the guy's money and it's a pure product which kind of runs on convenience. That kind of leeway.
The high volume, high velocity product.
High volume, high velocity, very, very low margin, thin margin, paper thin margin. When you're starting, your data models, your credit algos are also kind of getting refined with each and every passing week, each and every passing month. And you really want to learn from the mistakes. And fortunately, there are not a lot that we have done because we have been, Amit and myself, we come from the same background. We are both bankers. So some of these things kind of already runs in the DNA.
Right. And you had an insider perspective of fraud. Essentially, I think if I had to summarize in one line, what is the challenge that you're facing right now? It is strong anti-fraud mechanism. That is what you want to build before you switch on the acquisition engine.
Oh, yes. And we are fairly, I would say that I'm fortunate to have such a passionate team in the company. We are fairly at an advanced stage. At that level. And now we are looking at that some of the recent partnerships that we have done, we actually signed up with the biggest, gym company in the country. So now people don't really have to.
Yeah, that's a great product to do it to EMIs. Yeah, yeah. Because typically gyms have this New Year, special pricing and, pay for the whole year in advance. And that's always a pain. Ek lump sum big payment. Yeah. Whereas monthly payment in a gym is super expensive. So that's a great category. Yeah.
Yeah. So the biggest guy in the space is your partner now. And we were just waiting for this moment of QR code launch. And next week we are actually launching 50 centers of the same brand across the country. And I think that's going to be a huge, and again, staying true to the thesis, can we deliver a real value prop to all the partners that we have?
Tell me something. Is there like a rule of thumb in BNPL, for example, that if you offer BNPL to customers, your sale goes up by 10% or 20% or something? Is there some how beneficial is BNPL? Is there some industry standard on how beneficial it is? Because everybody wants to do BNPL. What is the data behind it that...
I'll tell you. So we don't have that data in the country, unfortunately. We are not that rich when it comes to the data. But I was actually reading a couple of reports on US, right? And that's where I think BNPL has been as a phenomenon. Also from a technology standpoint, has been existing for almost a decade now. And there are very, very large listed companies already over there. And in this report, which I'm not able to recollect the publisher, but what interestingly it said, that there is almost a 30% increase.
That's massive. Okay, that is massive.
30% is massive. And I'm not like very surprised, because this is what we hear from our merchant partners almost every week. Almost every week. Now, I'll tell you a funny instance. We had actually shut down a particular category. Category at a category level. That, hey, we're not just not going to probably enter. We're not ready for that. There are higher chances of fraud.
Is there anything you're doing to try and capture that data of how much bump you will deliver?
So, we are actually putting a mechanism in place, which is not foolproof. And we don't really have a lot of data, but we are trying to iterate in that space that, hey, can we really start capturing this data? This is going to be huge and very, very meaningful data for us.
Yeah, that's like the easiest way to sell the product is just to show that, So,
in fact, one another interesting fact, right? At such early on in the journey, today we own about 70% of the bicycle space. We are tied up with almost all everyone. And we're selling bicycles like hotcakes. These days it's a little down because I think there's a general tendency not to buy bicycles during winters. But as soon as I think it opens up, we land up into February, the entire trend is going to pick up like a rocket ship again.
So you're okay talking numbers? Like I'm really curious to know that, how many merchants have you onboarded so far? What is your monthly run rate and stuff like that? Like that would be interesting to know, and especially the growth also, how you've been growing.
Well, I can tell you from a percentage basis, and I mean merchant number is fine. I mean I'm more than happy to kind of share that. So today we are sitting at a merchant number of about 16,000 odd merchant partners,
and which is deliberately kept small because you want to build those anti-fraud mechanisms first.
Oh yes, I mean practically we have not been going after the acquisition stuff from the last 2 months. Whatever the 16,000 number came in, it just came in like 3-4 months time period. And then it was a moment of thought that, hey, we already got 16,000. Do we really need to add more and really start chasing a very, very large number, which probably you may or may not be able to service at scale, or we pick up a cohort of about 5,000 to 10,000 merchants who really matter. And most likely these are the merchants which have been recommended by the brands where we have the partnerships, because there is a lot of organic signups also. When people hear us about us in the market, they just get excited and they download the application, register themselves. But at this stage, probably it's not best advisable to start serving every single 16,000 merchants. So why can't we really pick up a cohort of about 10,000, 7,000 merchants out of this entire stuff? And we build a strategy, evolve the product that, hey, let's work with these 7,000 folks and really try and test out that what are the challenges we are facing, which are industry specific, geo specific, and product specific. How can we fix them? And how can we deliver a real value prop? And this iteration of introducing a QR code, this iteration of making the entire consumer journey independent was directly in line of that.
What is, so merchants who are active users, what is like the average credit disbursed per merchant? Like, you know, what value, like a lakh a month or more than that? Or
so this is a good number. 70% of the, and this is a funnel, like this is a funnel, right? So 70% of our merchants actually come on top of the funnel, which I'll tell you. So when I say top of the funnel, these are the guys who have an intention to transact with PayTel, who are coming on the application. They're initiating the transaction with the consumers. With whatever capacity, right? Because this guy could be located in a very, very small town and I may not have enough data on the guy. I'm not probably able to deliver that credit decision. And this guy does not make it to the bottom of the funnel. About 30% of this entire merchant ecosystem are the ones who make it to the bottom of the funnel. And on an average, we do about 2.5 to 3 transactions per merchant on an average. There are a few large merchants who would actually end up giving us about 70-80 transactions also in a month. And there would be a few guys, because they are located in a small town, and also because a majority of the categories that we are going after are the ones which have already always remained unaware of a BNPL product in their category. Like, for example, talk about cycle. The cycle guy never knew that you can actually sell a cycle. So they are also getting accustomed and attuned now. So there would be a guy who probably doing only 2 transactions, and there'd be 1 transaction, and there'd be a guy who's doing about 50, 60 transactions. On an average, each of our merchant partner gives about 2.5 to 3 transactions in a month. That's been the overall run rate. So I'll put it like this. Our average GMV, or the gross merchandise value that we sell on the platform, comes out to about 28,000 rupees. And not per merchant, this per transaction.
Yeah, so you were saying the average GMV per transaction is 28,000.
Yeah, so average GMV per transaction is that. And what we are expecting from all the merchants, even including the long tail ones, even if on an average, we are able to unlock a 1 lakh rupee GMV, every merchant, every single merchant that's there in the ecosystem, it's a huge lifetime value at a merchant level that you're looking at. Massive.
Yeah. It's like changing the lifestyle of that merchant, you know, like 12 lakhs annual increase in your sales means like, you know, you can send your kids to a better school, for example. Like,
yeah. People are sending photographs here on our support channel. A guy just sold 5 bicycles in about half an hour to 5 different consumers. And I was so goddamn happy about it that this has never happened to my business. What's happening? And this is the impact that we are chasing as a business. The only question here is, an equation which we are trying to balance and figure out. How can you replicate the same level of impact and enthusiasm across the merchant ecosystem? But the main question, prominent question, remains the same. Thus, impact which we delivered on this bicycle guy who sold 5 cycles in half an hour just because there was a simple affordability solution which was there on the counter. How can we replicate the same impact across the merchant ecosystem? And this is how the journey looks like now.
Yeah. Both of you are non-technical, like you know, you're both on the business side. How did you build the technology part of it? I mean, because this is like, you know, you need machine learning algorithms and all of that to be in place to enable this to work successfully at scale. So how did you do that?
Well, Akshay, I mean, yes, I mean, we are both are non-tech guys. But I think we got a decent level of exposure from a technology standpoint in our three and a half, four years of career with Priority Vendor come CTFO. You know, but on top of it, the thesis here is that the solutions are available if you ask for it. You can really, you know, accelerate the entire learning curve by talking to a lot of people around who have already done those mistakes. So when we started off, we actually had no clue how all of the tech stack and everything is going to work out. With help from people, our friends and everything, we set up a good and solid engineering team. And that is where we never kind of, you know, thought of not investing, because that's a capability being a tech company that you need first before anything else, even before your first enterprise client, even before your first merchant. What you really need is a very, very solid tech stack. And now we also have a CTO who's actually joining us in the first week of Jan, and also kind of helping us out on some of the very, very ambitious plans that we have now. Because
what are those ambitious plans? Are you at liberty to share a few? I mean, I'd love to hear.
Now, what we're also thinking of, to revamp the entire application infra to give them better control, to give them better visibility, as well as now we're also introducing, and I can't share those specs, and I will shortly share that as and when we want to reveal it. It's going to be a paid-in premium reseller program. And if there are merchants who are falling in that paid-in premium resellers program, then there are some incremental incentives that they get, not really in form of only cashback, right? Because that's how the thesis. In terms of even increased value proposition, can we really offer their consumers who are walking into the doorstep something which really makes them excited that this is the shop I really want to buy it from?
Mm-hmm. Better financing terms and stuff like that.
Not really. It's going to be super exciting. It's going to be better financing term is something we can solve today. that's only an incremental advantage. So the way we are planning is that, look, if a merchant is completing about 5 transactions with me in a month, I'm actually going to upgrade him to a category of a premium reseller. And for a premium reseller, there's going to be a dedicated account manager types. And that account manager, instead of handling 500 merchants, he would now be handling only 200 merchants, 150 merchants. It's a real kind of line of support. That's
faster approval. Instead of 10 minutes, it'll be like 2 minutes or something like that. Hmm.
And the second thought process is that in exchange of that, can we actually offer some sort of 10% instant cashback to every single purchase that the consumer is doing on the counter? And that cashback is actually going to work across all the paid-in premium resellers, wherever the consumer wants to go, right? That is second. And the third is going to be that we are also introducing something called paid-in nearby merchants in the consumer application, where the consumer can, where the listing of these merchants will actually be on the priority.
Yeah. Essentially, you're powering a loyalty scheme for them. Like this becomes a loyalty scheme for them. Yeah. Across that network of premium resellers. 10% is massive. Like 10% you gave me as an example, or you're actually planning 10%?
We are actually planning that. And that's the reason I did not want to disclose, because we are actually running some mathematics. On top of it, it actually sounds fitting, because that cashback is not an immediate cash burn that we are doing. It is something that you are putting in a wallet or something, which the consumer can only utilize across my stores.
Right. That's like a game changer. That's like really going to boost the B2C part of the business then.
That's right.
And increases the value proposition for the merchant also, because then you're enabling discovery, you're enabling loyalty, like, you know, both those things you're enabling. They are more equipped to become an Amazon in a way. You know, this becomes like a Prime, Amazon Prime membership kind of a equivalent.
This was our first tagline, in fact, actually, what you just said. How can I make every merchant an Amazon? How can I empower him so much from all the possible angles? Convenience, affordability, loyalty. That's all you need, right?
So how have you funded it so far? Because, I mean, building a tech team costs a lot, right? So,
well, two parts. Our business runs on revenue. And we make a good amount on that, number one. And we are also funded by one of the largest corporate houses of the country, which is Cholamandalam Group. We recently raised about $1.5 million from them. And before that, I'd also done a $200,000, $300,000 seed round, or the pre-seed kind of round from my group of friends and angels, right? Friends and family, $300,000. And now we are actually looking at when some of these products go live in the next 2 months, and that's when we start looking at the fruits. That's when we'll look for the next round. And the ambitions in that direction are large. Because earlier it was only me and Amit. Now we are a fully powered team. And there are leadership people joining across the company. Super passionate people. And I'm so excited to kind of work with all of these.
If you like the Founder Thesis podcast, then do check out our other shows on subjects like marketing, technology, career advice, books, and drama. Visit thepodium.in, that is thepodium.in, for a complete list of all our shows.
Before we end the episode, I want to share a bit about my journey as a podcaster. I started podcasting in 2020, and in the last 2 years, I've had the opportunity to interview more than 250 founders who are shaping India's future across sectors. If you also want to speak to the best minds in your field and build an enviable network, then you must consider becoming a podcaster. And the first step to becoming a podcaster starts with Zencastr, which takes care of all the nuts and bolts of podcasting, from remote recording to editing to distribution and finally monetization. If you're planning to check out the platform, then please show your support for the Founder Thesis podcast by using this link, zen.ai/founderthesis. That's zen.ai/founderthesis.